Well, I guess we have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order. Representative Poppy has read the minutes.
I have. I'd like to move the minutes, please.
Thank you, Madam Representative Poppy. Are there any additions or suggestions to the minutes? Hearing none. All those in favor of approving the minutes of 2015, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same. Having heard none, minutes are approved. Members, we have Bob Isaacson, Director of Communications and Analysis and Research from DEED. That is, I guess the chart's up on the viewing screen, and you have a copy in front of you. I have spent the last couple of weeks looking at this more and more, particularly in how we are, our charges, workforce, bioscience, and one of the charges that I think in this economic time is how do we enhance the workforce. So I wanted to find out what we're supposed to enhance and ask Mr. Isaacson to provide this. So with no more to be said, I will turn it over to Mr. Isaacson and ask him to explain this. Thank you and welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Isaacson. I'm Director of Communications Analysis and Research with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. I think some would say they would take a couple weeks just to try to understand this. The good news is it's a lot of information. The bad news is it's a lot of information. So I'm glad to have an opportunity to share with you some thoughts on how we might take a look at this. These, what they're called, bubble charts, really tell us three things. The size of a particular industry relative to other industries, and that's represented by the bubble. The bigger the bubble is, the more employees they have, that industry has in the state. The second factor or economic data point that these present is the relative growth of employment in the state of that particular industry. If you look on the left-hand side, it says employment change, and as the viewer screen right now, I think, has the Minnesota chart up being presented, displayed. On the left-hand side, employment change, as I said, you can see the percentage there, 0, 5%, and moving up. As you see, as the bubbles are higher up on the graph, they've grown. The ones in the lower half have grown less or have actually contracted in terms of employment size. So we have, so far we have the bubble, the larger the bubble, the more employees. The higher the bubble is on the chart, the more it's grown or the more employees it's added. The last item that it helps understand is how big this industry is relative to a national measure, and that's location quotient. If an industry has the same percentage of employment in Minnesota as it does nationally, the location quotient would be 1. And that means that we're probably about the same competitiveness as the national average. A good example of that is leisure and hospitality. We're about the national average in terms of our share of leisure and hospitality industry in Minnesota as it is, as it represents the nation. As you go right, though, that looks at industries that are more concentrated here than the national average, and that suggests industries that have a little bit more competitive advantage here and also industries that are larger relative to the national average and probably bring money in or income in and export goods and services as well. So size, growth, and relative concentration relative to the U.S. average are the three items that are expressed by this presentation. Now, if you divide this chart into four quadrants, the upper right-hand quadrant would be those industries that are growing rapidly and have a high concentration here in the state. The lower left-hand quadrant would be the ones that are not growing and have a less than typical concentration in the state. One couple things I wanted to just mention to help you get a relative perspective on this particular chart or these charts. They only include jobs with employers, so they don't include self-employment. It's only private sector employment, so it underestimates some industries, perhaps like some healthcare or some education, for example. In this particular case, we've used those industries that are fairly large but not too disaggregated. We use the North American industry classification system, and we use within that industry classification system, you can start with the largest industries, which, for example, would be goods producing and service producing, and then you can narrow it down to something very small and minutiae-like. We've kind of taken the middle ground and taken the 80 largest industries in the state. We can cut and slice and dice a little bit further if that is something that you'd like to see to help you better understand some of the priorities you'd like to set as you move forward. And it also, although it does provide some information on growth and relative concentration, which suggests exports and wages, it generally doesn't produce or provide that type of information. So it just provides information on employment and relative size of the industry itself. With that, I don't want to get too much further into the details of the chart. Mr. Chair, any questions or anything else you'd like me to address moving forward?
I will allow the committee to ask them. I have a couple myself, so I think Representative Pepin, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Isaacson. I'm wondering if you could just let me know what is included under social assistance. What types of things does that include?
Social assistance is generally characterized, by Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, social assistance is generally included within health care and education, and within social assistance would be types of assistance that's provided to elderly, types of assistance given to folks who are vulnerable. So generally, you might also include assistance provided to through United Way type functions, any type of activities that are there to help societal aims or goals.
Mr. Isaacson, you spoke to a national register of jobs or classification of employment. I don't remember the exact phrase that it was. Is that available online? Or is that some big book you have in your office?
Mr. Chair, it is a big book, but it is also online. It's the North American Industrial Classification System.
Could you send a link to the committee members so they get an opportunity if they wanted to kind of figure out what animal production or heavy and civil construction or what those classifications would fall under?
Certainly. Please.
Thank you. And if you can get to the staff, that'd be good too. I think Representative Winkler had a question.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I just lost the presenter's name. Is it
Isaacson?
Isaacson. Mr. Isaacson, I'm looking at the corporate headquarters bubble, and wondering if you could just give a little more comparison. I assume, for example, in the Twin Cities, it's obviously higher than it is on a statewide basis. But if you compare the Twin Cities and Minnesota generally, how does that corporate headquarters bubble stack up? I know we've got this really high concentration, but is that typical for other major metropolitan areas, or do you have any kind of sense of how Minnesota or the Twin Cities might compare nationally in that regard?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Twin Cities is generally known, and even the data suggests and support that we have a higher concentration of corporate headquarters than other similarly sized metropolitan areas. Even if you look at something as simple as Fortune 500 companies, we have 19 Fortune 500 companies ranking, actually 18 in the Twin Cities area, which ranks top 10 in terms of metropolitan areas, and the Twin Cities is about, I think, 15th in terms of size. So we have a higher than expected concentration of corporate headquarters. And when you go into other things like private companies, Cargill is a great example of that as a corporate headquarters, and even traded companies that aren't Fortune yet, we're quite high there as well. So we generally have a quite high concentration of corporate headquarters in the Twin Cities and in the state as well.
Mr. Chair, I guess my only, and it appears that the growth is continuing as well. Does it look like it's above average growth or about average growth compared to all these sectors? Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's accurate.
And then my comment, I guess, Mr. Chair, and this is not to Mr. Isaacson, I'll save him from this, which is that if indeed Minnesota has the third highest corporate income tax rates in the world if we were a country, as the governor maintained. It's a miracle almost that we were able to maintain this number of corporate headquarters in our state.
It's a miracle day. Representative Brannick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a logistical question here. Are the colors relevant to, I mean, is this just designed to have them contrast to each other? There seems some continuity between the greater Minnesota color coding and the state, and not true with the metro, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brannick, no, the colors are not significant other than to add some color. But I would add that you're not the first person to ask that, so it probably would behoove us to note that on the charts that the colors are not of significance. Thank you.
Representative Gottwell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reacting a little bit, Mr. Chair, to Representative Winkler's comments. I hope he was not implying complacency in that our corporate tax environment has already caused us to lose at least one of those Fortune 500s. The reason Northwest Airlines relocated its headquarters was specifically and very pointedly because of our tax environment. And lest we lose our ranking as one of the top places for Fortune 500 companies, I think we need to be very cognizant of the impact of our tax and regulatory climate in Minnesota. So this is good information, though. I thank you for sharing it.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question here on the seven county metro area. Bottom of the chart, you go from 0.4, 0.9, 0.14. Where is the national average on that? Is it the right after the 0.9? So
in terms of the location quotient, Mr.
Chief? Yes.
It would be just a hair over the 0.9. If you look at between 0.9 and 1.4 and divide that into fifths, that would be the first quintile, the first fifth would be the 1.0.
Okay. That's I thought that, but I wanted to point that out so that everyone kind of had a better sense of that. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was kind of my question, too, as I'm looking at the understanding the bubble chart sheet, and it talks about the quadrants on the chart, what delineates the quadrant on, like, when we have minus 7% and 3%. I'm understanding, I guess, the horizontal dark line would be about the 0% line, and so we can, at a glance, then, Mr. Isaacson, anything upper right of 1 and of the line, it just at a glance, would indicate growing industries that we should be grateful for, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, yes, indeed, anything north of that line there. One of the challenges, I think, when we put together all this information is trying to capture it all within some type of metric sense. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing some good suggestions and perhaps some baselines that we can add to this to help improve the comprehension of just look at a glance, trying to understand it. So adding a line for the 1.0 and adding some of the other measures might help with the initial glance to understand this particular chart. I would add, Mr. Chair, that although we did this Greater Minnesota chart, Greater Minnesota has very disparate regional economies, and we just put this together just to get a sense of what the area outside of Twin Cities area looks like. We're in the midst of doing this bubble chart for the I think six different regions outside the state right now. We can get a sense of that.
Actually, that leads to, I've got a couple of things, but that leads to my real question, and I want to get to the commissioners relatively quickly. Other, like the workforce councils, I think there's 16 of them around the state, have they asked for something similar to this, or data that would align itself with this kind of information so that they know as they try to plan out where they're going, they have an idea of what they're trying to plan for?
Mr. Chair, we're fortunate that we have 5 labor market analysts stationed outside the state and one inside the Twin Cities area that do a significant amount of work with the Workforce Investment Boards. And many times they ask for something similar to this, sometimes the exact same type of chart, but they ask for a lot and lot of information to help them understand their regional economic base so they can better plan their workforce development and delivery activities.
Thank you. Members, Mr. Eisen is relatively simple to get a hold of. These are a good idea for us to kind of keep an idea of how we look at the industries in the state. I thought it was important for us to see this kind of information is there for us to take advantage of. And seeing no other questions, I appreciate your the work that you do and the comments that you made. So again, it'd be nice to know where I could find the listings of everything that's in here, and I'm sure you'll send that on. Thank you.
Absolutely, thank you.
I'm sorry, was there another question?
No, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to comment that you talked about this, that southern Minnesota, southern and southwest, have been having meetings over the course of the last 6 months, I believe, through the initiative fund to talk about economic development, and I know you're aware of that, but I just, you know, as you asked about the workforce centers, if they're involved in it, I know that the initiative fund is and the workforce centers and people throughout southeastern and southwestern Minnesota looking at how we can continue to grow as a region and not necessarily concentrate just in by city or by regional center, but more by the region. Just wanted to comment on that.
Representative Poppy, you're right. I have been following the southern part of the state kind of closely. Folks down there do a pretty good job. Members, today we have the commissioners of Commerce and Deed in front of the committee to present to the committee. I'm sure there are some questions that we all have. My purpose in asking them here was to kind of find out what they told the governor on, I'm trying to think what they called it, the Economic Outlook Analysis Team. But I do want the committee to understand some of the, well, Commissioner Wilson is here, although we don't have any policy oversight of Commerce that I'm truly aware of unless there's workforce in Commerce, and I've heard rumors of that. I haven't found any just yet, real hard lessons there. So the reason we called Commissioner Wilson here is to kind of hear what he and Commissioner McElroy spoke to the governor on, and I certainly understand if the commissioner has other duties that he has to attend to. We do have more oversight over Deed, and we appreciate you coming. And Commissioner McElroy, welcome to the committee. Commissioner Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, I think the plan will be that I will start, Commissioner Wilson and I will both comment on the work we've been doing in this area, and then we'll be available for your questions. In early October of 2008, following the meltdown of Bear Stearns, the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, and the forced sale of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America, Governor asked Commissioner Wilson and I to study the impact that that would have and to talk to a number of constituencies about the impact of those national market forces on Minnesota's banking and financial industries and on the business community. The Division of Labor was that Commissioner Wilson spoke with a wide variety of banks and insurance companies. And I worked with our 9 small business development centers around the state and held 16 listening sessions in communities, principally in greater Minnesota, but 5 of them in the metro area, to listen to groups of members gathered by economic development agencies, chambers of commerce, and some trade associations as to the impact of the financial markets on their business, particularly as it applied to the availability of credit. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we'd like to begin by, we'll start on the banking and insurance side and then go to the business impact side. And so Commissioner Wilson will begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. First, I'd like to apologize for last week. Sorry we had a conflict, but we're pleased to have an opportunity to come back this week. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that, and committee members. The other thing I'd like to mention is that the comments are not my own, nor the department or the governor's. This is a report of information that we gathered from our meetings, and I'd like to go through some of the ideas that we picked up first. I know that you were very kind to give us seven areas of interest that the committee had, the last being some of the ideas. I'll start with those. First off, Grow Minnesota campaign was mentioned by several people. They thought that could be renewed or jump-started. Make Minnesota more attractive to business. That was very generic. First-time home buyers, two-year property tax credit. There are several issues relative to the building industry, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But the moratorium on new land developments for up to 1 to 3 years, not start any new area of activity, because even though new housing that's on the market is down about 50% from 2 years ago, it's still very high. And the developed lot inventory around particularly the Twin Cities area is very high as well. So they were looking for some kind of a moratorium on new developments for 1 to 3 years. Item five, the state fund to help developers carry and or promote the development projects that are already in place. Many of them are having a significant difficulty with the carrying costs on that. Reduced insurance premiums would be another benefit to the community businesses. Lift the ban on nuclear plants, encourage investment in Minnesota, encourage investment in Minnesota companies, because as was just mentioned here in prior testimony, they have it right and they're growing and they're strong. Now, who did we consult with? Dan already mentioned a couple areas, but I concentrated on the bankers, the insurance companies, mortgage bankers, some of the areas that we regulate. The electric utilities, I visited with the Federal Reserve, builders, and others. So that gives you a little bit of a cross-section of who we talked to. And in terms of banks, the first week in October when we were out, and a lot of the news was very negative, Banker Surety of Kansas provides backup for a lot of the community banks in the state. They announced that week that they were getting out of the business. The Federal Home Loan Bank in Des Moines, which also supports a lot of the community banks, particularly on real estate, withdrew a lot of their overlines. It's typical that a lot of our banks will ask for a credit line from the Federal Home Loan Bank for significantly more than they actually need, just so that they know that they can continue to do business against that line. Well, the Federal Reserve Bank was tightening up and reducing that line in October and November. Metropolitan banks are feeling the pinch more than the outstate banks, mostly because the best portion of the market that they can typically lend to is the construction and development loans. The marginal profit there is stronger, and they have less competition in that area. So that's typically where the community banks in the Twin Cities would lend money. And they were holding cash. At that period in time, and it hasn't changed, one thing, reading this weekend's paper and even this morning's paper, front page of the business side, is talking about banks and their lending practices. But one of the things that that was clear, that the banks have money. The problem was then, and I think it continues till today, is that they're reticent because the withdrawals at that point were higher than typical. They were holding money because their assets that they had lent on were deteriorating rapidly, and they might have to raise additional cash. So that was a serious issue. Lending was being tightened, there's no question about that, but money was available. And on the small business, it was actually competitive. with those businesses that had pretty good credit ratings. Out-of-state banks in this type of an economy typically are a little bit weaker than the Twin Cities area, but this time it's reversed. The out-state banking community is fairly strong, and some of the weaknesses experienced here closer at home. Insurance companies have very strong cash positions, but again, because of Sarbanes-Oxley, they were holding cash. Their portfolio was deteriorating. The cash call was anticipated. Plus, I think some of them said, frankly, that they were holding the money thinking that there would be better investment opportunities down the road. So, but otherwise, it was business as usual for the banks. On the energy side, they were harder hit. Expansion and improvement require a lot of capital, and they were having a very difficult time raising capital for the expansion and improvements. Xcel, as an example, has skipped about $1 billion worth of improvements this year, and that a lot of it has to be borrowed. Also, money for the fuel was spiking dramatically at that time, and they were borrowing short term to cover until the consumers paid for that, and that short term money was not only tight but almost non-existent. So there again, it was an indication of tighter money. All the above and somewhat, no matter where I went and who I talked to, money was tight. The impact overall, and I'll read some of these because I know that you're interested. Money was tight in October, no question, but the money was available. It was being held. Gradually returning to more normal markets, I think, in the last 2 months, somewhat. Credit worthiness is an issue. Lenders are holding assets, looking for opportunities to expand. State banks, typically, we have five categories that we audit to. Category 3, 4, and 5 we consider somewhat on the watch list. 10 to 12 are typically, historically. Today they're slightly over 50. Same way on the insurance side. Not the same way. On the insurance side, historically we have about 10 or 12, but there's only 100 companies that we audit that are domiciled in the state. On the banking side, there are 336. So 50 is a smaller, or is a significant increase. On the insurance side, 10 to 12 has been pretty stable over time. That's about where we are out of the 100 today. So on the insurance side, there's not a whole lot of change. The real estate and bond market investing is on the insurance companies. They typically lend money for commercial real estate, long-term, 30-year commitments for shopping centers, apartment complexes, and the like. So their portfolio, as well as the bond market portfolio, has declined a little bit, which put some pressure on them for looking for new business. So one of the things that I am convinced of, that there's a lot of cash in the banking industry, there's a lot of cash in the insurance industry today, and individuals are holding a lot of cash. But there's absolutely no confidence in our market today. People can defer furniture, housing, cars, suits, whatever. They're deferring the purchase. And so with Wall Street and Washington constantly hammering on, it's the worst is not yet here, people are reticent to spend. And that's true of business as well as individuals. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, for giving this opportunity.
We have a couple of questions here, but I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair. Could you share with the committee? Did you meet with the governor on this on your advisory board? And did you share anything with the governor?
Mr. Chairman, we reported back to the governor through his staff, through the chief of staff and the senior policy advisors on business and finance, who in turn shared with the governor. I've talked to the governor informally, and he's aware of this issue. it is one that's changing fairly rapidly. As Commissioner Wilson indicated, credit markets are improving somewhat. One of the major problems for some industries, particularly the auto dealers and the housing industry, has been what I would call the freeze-up of the national commercial paper market and the national bond market. Those have slowly started to thaw. So we keep the governor informed on an ongoing basis, but we didn't have a formal meeting with him. We relayed our information through his team.
Is that correct, Commissioner Wilson?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So, and I will ask this of you, Commissioner McElroy. Commissioner Wilson, did you share anything with Chief of Staff Kramer or members as to suggestions from this committee that you were asked to chair or sit on?
Mr. Chair, members, not directly. I did report almost everything here as I just give it to you. The same notes were used to talk to the policy people that Commerce reports to.
Thank you. Representative Bid?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Wilson, and this may require, Mr. Chair, a whole committee meeting just on how we relate to banking and oversee state charter banks on, but I'm aware...
It's also the committee, though.
Oh, okay, yeah, it would be, I'm afraid. But in this regard, and how it affects the our faith-based economy and how people are feeling about things, especially I'm thinking small businesses and people that need access to lines of credit for inventory and so on. Not only that, but folks, just regular folks like me that maybe want to update my 1996 pickup truck that's sitting on it because the banks just aren't feeling real friendly right now about loaning money for things like that. Who adjusts the lending requirements and oversees what the banking regulators look for when they walk into a bank with their book of rules and regulations and so on? Is that something that you're... agency does? Do you kind of set those benchmarks and tighten them up or loosen them up, or where does that come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, the guidelines are fairly broad and set regularly, or they are pretty much recognized by the industry, so that we're not adjusting them every time we're in. What we're doing is reviewing the assets against the liability and trying to match the longer term, medium term, short term against assets. But the banks themselves know when their liquidity is changing and try to change accordingly. This downturn happened relatively quick, so if you're a little bit longer term, you just have to tighten up the short term to get in balance, if that's of any help. But we're not changing the rules as we go.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard, I'm comfortable with the leeway here, but this you're veering into Commerce, and Joe Atkins might, his office is down the hall from me, and I'd hate to get a visit from him, so be careful there.
Send him over to see me. I'd be happy to chat him about this. But if we're looking at workforce development, I know having been a small businessman, access to credit lines when things were tight was vital to keeping payroll paid, for instance, which I found my employees really took a dim view of moving payroll back a day or two. And then, of course, there's the revenue department that likes their payroll tax deposits and so on. And more than one time, I went in with my hat in my hand to see my friendly neighborhood banker to borrow to cover that. But then, of course, that assumes that business will be perking up at some point during a repayment period, which is why I'm asking, because I have had a couple times when I walked in the door and got my foot slammed in the door because the banking regulators were walking out as I was walking in, and they had just changed capital requirements or lending guidelines and things like that, and all of a sudden I was no longer, I fell outside of whatever had been tightened up, and I wasn't sure if that was feds or if those were state guys that were monkeying with that. And so I think it's important for this committee to know just how much slack or room to manipulate those kind of things Commerce Department has, and it sounds to me like it's not so much commerce as it is just good business practice. And I know apparently then banks just kind of watch out for each other, and people that loan money to banks and buy stocks in banks also pay attention to those ratios. And I guess that's what I was trying to ferret out of Commissioner Wilson. I do have one other related one that does have to do with job formation also. And it relates to the energy mandates we've been laying on commerce. I think there's at least 17 or 18 studies your department's working on, and one of the things I have concern about is that we have a couple of very solid, substantial industries in this state, steel making being one of them, oil refining being another one, grain drying, and the list goes on and on, that eat up enormous amounts of energy. How are the mandates that we've been so happily keeping on the energy users of this state, how has that been affecting our business climate and the cost of doing business? Do you guys keep track of that at all, or do you pretty much just respond to whatever it is we tell you to do without an eye to the costs there?
Well, I'll answer first, Mr. Chair and members, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague. You're right about the number of studies that are due. We have nine due between today and the end of February. And most of those are pretty well along and have been a year in the works. But so there are a number of studies being done. To answer your question, it is a balancing act all the time between renewable energy and cost. It's a significant, our department advises the PUC on behalf of the consumer. So the cost for industry and the consumer is very much a consideration in looking at new projects, whether it be new generation or transmission. It's regularly a balancing act. And we're made aware of it by industry for sure, and not the least the consumers, but industry is often making their case for the need to stay competitive.
Representative Anderson, did you have a question? Thank you, thank you, Commissioner. Did you have a question?
There's a little bird whispered in my ear.
Gotwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the commissioners, both of them, what are some of the strategies we are looking at now from your offices, from the governor's office? I'm sure we're going to hear more as the budget comes out and so forth. But what are some of the strategies we're pursuing from both your offices in trying to turn things around? You mentioned we got a lot of cash, but people are hanging on to it because they have low confidence. What are some of the things we're doing from a policy perspective to trying to turn that around?
Mr. Commissioner, before we get to that, I think that's a great question, and I'd love to have you answer that. I was wondering, would you mind if we had Commissioner McElroy go through his presentation, and then, because I think that is actually, hopefully he'll cover some of that in his remarks, and we can expand not just on that base question, but go a little farther. But before I call on the commissioner, I would like to welcome Representative Slocum to the committee. This is, I believe, your first meeting. You weren't feeling entirely up to snuff, and we're glad to have you here, and this hopefully will be a nonpartisan, fun committee to spend your time on, and you'll learn a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm back from the near dead.
Commissioner McElroy.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. My part of the assignment was to visit with business people of all sizes around the state. And we did that in two ways. One is I asked our nine small business development centers, which are headquartered, one in the metro area and eight around the state, to talk to their advisory groups and their clients about the impact of the credit market. And secondly, I held 16 listening sessions, meetings, Chamber of Commerce events, Trade Association events in October, November, and early December, five of them in the metro area and 11 in greater Minnesota. And this is what we learned. There was more difficulty in accessing new credit than in maintaining existing relationships. Most banks are continuing to make money available to their current customers, but are more resistant to taking on new clients or taking on new businesses. Small businesses reported through our SBDCs that in a couple of cases, particularly in northeastern Minnesota, they've had some credit lines restrained. If they had been borrowing on average of $50,000, but they had an $80,000 credit line, their credit lines were reduced to what they've been using, not unlike what Commissioner Wilson reported. that can be problematic to highly seasonal businesses. We reported dramatically more stress among banks in suburban and metro neighborhoods than in greater Minnesota for the reasons Commissioner Wilson noted. A banker in White Bear, for example, told me that because of, it was a banker, but it was in conjunction with a meeting of a group of business people, and he was talking around a table that also had business borrowers, and saying they were essentially not taking new business and were very restrained on adding business because of having to mark assets from their residential construction loan portfolio to the current market. We heard similar things principally in the sessions I held around the metro area. In most areas of greater Minnesota outside of northeastern Minnesota banking was reported also to be fairly tight, as Commissioner Wilson described. There is money, but the things like debt to equity ratios were increased. Bankers were being more careful. More than one borrower said to me, and I think of a round table that held in the Grand Rapids area, saying, I'm asked more questions, I'm asked to produce more numbers. It is possible, but it's more difficult to get money. Outside of the Northeast, banks and business people were reporting less impact. The impact in some rural areas has been that the farmers have had three or four good years and have paid down what they may have borrowed at their bank. Now, understand that not all ag credit is in banks anymore, but equipment dealers are out of the bank. Many small businesses in greater Minnesota, in the farm intensely agricultural areas, were fairly good. A banker from northwestern Minnesota told me his loan-to-deposit ratio was about 38%. That's alarmingly low. That's good on the liquidity side, but it means he'll be challenged to make much money because many of his customers were out of the bank. So the circumstances are different regionally. Our small business development centers, business is to assist businesses all over the state in updating their business plans, preparing cash flow models, preparing collateral and various applications for banks. They're very busy, and I applaud that. I also met with three industry associations that are impacted quite differently. The car dealers, when we met with them in October and November, were in very serious circumstance. Their financing has evolved over the last 10 years away from banks and toward the large captive finance companies like Ford Credit, General Motors Credit, Chrysler Credit, and then the international companies each have their own credit arms. And those companies have lost access to the commercial paper market, and they're having major liquidity problems of their own. And as you saw, we lost, I believe, 40 auto dealers that closed or in some way changed hands in poor circumstances from October till the end of the year. I'm taking that number from memory, Mr. Chair, but it's close. The Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association can give it to you exactly. They were having both a challenge in getting wholesale credit for dealers called floor plan financing and retail financing. I'm pleased to report that in recent weeks that's improved fairly dramatically. Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association reported about 10 days ago that with some of the federal activities, with GMAC being made a bank and Chrysler Credit getting an infusion, and also the opening to a relatively minor extent of the commercial paper market nationally, floor planning has improved. Credit markets started to open up at Christmas time, but they have gotten better. Up until about 10 days ago, the minimum credit score to qualify for a low-interest loan was 720 on the Fair Isaacs scale. That's a very high credit score. About a week ago, that was reduced to 620, and that's a massive change. A huge number of Minnesotans have credit scores between 620 and 720. So the auto dealers, although their business is still slow on the new and used car sales, they happen to be busy on parts and service and rental, but not on where they the key part of the business, are reporting somewhat improved creditability recently. Second business that we've been talking to at great length is the single-family residential construction business. One of the reasons that Minnesota had greater unemployment than some other states was because we were impacted on the residential side very early. Between July of 2005 and October 2008, we lost in the NAICS codes around single-family residential. We lost about, I'm going to combine them, but in those NAICS codes, in building supply manufacturing and building supply distribution and the mortgage business, we lost more than 26,000 jobs. The housing, I want to say collapse, is a key part of Minnesota's challenge. And to put that in context, in the years prior to the bubble, it was not uncommon to have 40,000 new homes built in Minnesota. This year we will have about 8,000, or a decline of 75%, and that includes markets like Moorhead that have been little impacted by the downturn, and replacement housing in areas like the tornado damage in Rogers and Hugo, the flood in Browns Valley, and the flood in southeastern Minnesota. Those replacement homes count in that housing start number. And so the residential housing business has been very badly impacted, and that a lot has been on the credit side. It has been the percentage of sales that have been what are called lender intermediated or lender involved is high. Housing values have been low. The Builders Association reports that the good news is that mortgages are have become more available since mid-December. The credit scores, however, are relatively high. And we are returning, and I can let Commissioner Wilson comment, I think wisely, to credit standards that were more similar in 2005 or 2006 with value-to-loan ratios in the 80 to 90% range, although there are some exceptions to that. There are some low down payment requirements or opportunities, but in programs with income requirements that are higher than they had been in the past. But the good news is that the mortgage industry reports they now have absolute proof that their telephone systems do work. They had some doubts for a while because they've been beginning to get calls for refinancing at these rates in the 4.5 to 5 percentage point range, but they're only for those who have very good credit and high value-to-loan ratios. So the building industry is still down. They are looking for some help. The assistance to them, Mr. Chairman, is more likely to come from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency than from our agency. And I don't know if that agency comes in your purview or not, but I know Commissioner Bartholomew is working with the industry closely to see what we can do on the first-time homebuyer front and others. Third industry that's surprisingly impacted is the Minnesota Hospital Association. Hospitals rely on the bond and commercial paper market to finance their renovation needs to their long-term capital needs, and those markets have been almost closed since the middle of October. They are slowly starting to reopen. I'm aware that the YMCAs of Greater Twin Cities were able to make a nonprofit bond issue sale in the last week or 10 days. The Minnesota Housing Finance intends to take a revenue bond housing issue to market later this week or next week. This is the first time those markets have been available since October. But it continues to be extremely tight in those financing mechanisms. My overall report from my business visit is that credit markets are much tighter than they had been in the past. It is not a lack of money in banks. It is tight standards, and it's a lack of confidence. The chairman and I were at an event a week ago in which Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve talked about what has to happen for a recession to end. And it was a combination of liquidity, confidence, and time. And the more liquidity you have and the more confidence you have, the shorter the time, and the less of those two you have, the longer the time. I would argue that we are emerging from a liquidity crisis. We still have a confidence crisis. Mr. Chairman, if I could then answer Mr. Gottwalk's question. We're doing three things with existing programs, and the governor has some proposals before the legislature, and will likely have some more as part of the budget. In our existing programs, we're making heavy use of our small business development centers to help business in applying for SBA 2 programs. There's a 7A program that assists with working capital for inventory and receivables and can be used as general operating money. And there are 504 loans that can be used for real estate-based transactions. Some of those are not, unfortunately, for new real estate, but may involve mortgaging existing real estate to pay for operations. But those two programs are helpful. We're also beginning to make very aggressive use of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development Business Loan Guarantee Program. That program has been beefed up in recent years. We have gotten, I think, 5 guarantees that our agency has been helpful with. They can guarantee up to 80% of the owner's portion of a project. There is a down payment or equity requirement. They are only available in Greater Minnesota and in communities that are of less than 50,000, but they're available widely outside the metropolitan area. Secondly, we have been working with communities to make use where we can of the Minnesota Investment Fund. The Minnesota Investment Fund statute requires that new jobs be created or business expansions be involved, but we've done a number of Minnesota Investment Fund loans of late. Those are often in cooperation with other programs. And we have been talking to a variety of borrowers about the Minnesota Ag and Economic Development Loan Funds programs. It is available in manufacturing principally and is based on our industrial revenue bond allocation. We can do loans generally up to $4 million and generally done in collaboration with banks, generally involving real estate or real property as collateral. We also have a program available only in the metropolitan area and in low-income areas called the Urban Initiatives Small Loan Fund. Some of you have gotten letters from us telling you that we have made Urban Initiatives loans in your district. They are loans from $5,000 to $100,000. They have gone to small trucking companies, electrical contractors, tortilla bakeries, ethnic grocery stores. They're done in partnership with 16 community-based lenders, and we continue to be very excited about that program. It's a revolving loan fund that the legislature has assisted us in capitalizing over the last 20 years. In terms of new proposals, Governor has made 5 new proposals in the clean and green energy area. One is that we have taken on a great idea, that Senator Ellen Anderson and others, I believe, I'm unclear if this was, Representative Winkler was on this one, but he's been on a number of loans or bills in this area. And if I can ask, were you on Senator Anderson's green zone bill? I think it may have been Representative Welty that was on that one, but they were bills with House authors and Senate authors. But Senator Anderson had a great idea to do a derivative of job opportunity building zones for clean and green, and that could include the metropolitan area. The governor has proposed that. We've also taken on an idea from Senator Bach to provide a credit on the insurance gross premium tax for insurance companies that will create large investment pools available for new business in Minnesota, with a set aside from that to green business. We've also proposed an idea that has been introduced by a number of legislators over the years for an angel capital tax credit, an early stage angel investors tax credit that we are excited about. Fourth, we've proposed, and it gets to the question that Representative Baird asked, that we try to use the conservation requirement that utilities are required to reduce their consumption by 15% over, I think it's by 2030, and tie that to, it has not included the kind of small wind, small solar, or biodigesters that could create economic development. So the governor has asked that conservation credit apply to small-scale or distributed clean and green energy projects. And then finally, an idea that doesn't require a legislation but that we're excited about. Some of you may recall we had a Minnesota Cup business plan competition a few years ago. We now will have a clean and green technology governor's cup for business plans in the clean and green energy field, and we're getting a great deal of interest on that. We'll be kicking off now, and I believe we'll have it public in March and judging this summer. We are continuing to look at other ways to use our existing programs, but those are the new ideas that the governor has proposed thus far. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do any of the members have questions for Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner McElroy, Commissioner Wilson, talking with my bankers out in Wright County, and I sit on several boards there with bankers on them. They say that a lot of things that have happened with the banking industry also has to do with the federal government and things that have come down from the feds and their policies. How much does that affect you here in the state as far as your situation here with the lending and I take it the banking has basically taken it upon themselves to tighten their lending, and as was mentioned, they've gone not to newer accounts but stayed with the older accounts. But what is it that the feds have come in to impact you and your commissioner or your position with your situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of much new direction from the federal regulators relative to the way we audit banks. I will say, though, that in October there was a significant discussion about the collateral lines at the Federal Home Loan Bank in Des Moines. In fact, we had one of our top auditors go down and visit with them and make sure that we understood. It was interpreted that they were tightening dramatically, when in fact what it turned out to be is a lot of the banks have real estate and construction and development loans, and that collateral was depreciating dramatically and quickly, and the Home Loan Bank was throwing down the line or canceling the excess of that line so as to keep the ratio of the diminished value in line with the lending ratios. That's the only federal, other than just watching more carefully, I don't know of any other tightening.
Otherwise, no, I guess.
Interesting. Mr. Chairman, going back a few years, the requirement in the Sarbanes-Oxley law that assets be marked, that a evaluation of real estate or other real property be updated as values decline. So if a bank made a loan of $800,000 on a piece of property that had $1 million value, and because of declining real estate values, that piece of property now has a $600,000 value, they have to count some of that as non-performing and increase the amount of bank capital that's committed to that. That's not new particularly, but the fact that real estate values have declined and that the unbuilt lots, developed lots in suburban and exurban areas have declined in value has had a real impact. And what I suspect Representative Anderson is hearing is in areas like Wright and Sherburne County, where there are literally thousands of lots that may have had a market value of $150,000 24 months ago, are probably on the market for a fraction of that today.
Representative Overmuller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McElroy, my questions, I've got a couple of them, but the first is what you saw the purpose of the economic outlook analysis was. Was the driving force to be out there to try to assess where we are now or to set a plan for the future? Can you give us some more background on that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Overmuller, more of the first. Find out how does what we're reading in the paper really apply on the main streets of Minnesota? If I went, and interestingly, I had the opportunity to go to places like Hibbing and Grand Rapids and East Grand Forks and Moorhead and Wilmer and St. James, and it looks different in many of those communities than it did, for example, in Brooklyn Park. And so it was a fact-finding mission. Separate from that, we always are looking for the question, what can we do to do our mission better? And in the case of our agency, we have the opportunity to use the Small Business Development Centers, to use the work we do with community economic developers, and to use programs like the Minnesota Investment Fund, the Ag and Economic Development Fund, and the Urban Initiatives Program. And we're working those as hard as their capital makes possible. And then we were obviously involved with the governor, as was the Department of Commerce, in the Clean and Green Initiative. And they came about this time.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, the
Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, as you know, Commissioner, I'm new to the committee here. We met just the other day here from both from Dakota County, and you know, you gave some testimony earlier about you know, this is basically a crisis of confidence, and Commissioner Wilson mentioned that as well. And to me, that comes down to, you know, making sure build security in the job growth, security in jobs and job growth. Did the commission, the economic outlook analysis team, do any investigation as to how employees were feeling about job growth and job security?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ober Mueller, the team was Commissioner Wilson and I, and then some staff who supported us. So it was not an extensive effort. And no, not as part of that effort. Now, we talk to employees in workforce centers, I do and my team does, but that's separate from this work. This work was simply, is what's happening on Wall Street impacting Minnesota banks and businesses? And what we found was, yes, it is. It's a differential impact. It is not a lack of money. It is, but it has tightened up credit, particularly in suburban and exurban areas, less so in greater Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair, then this might be a discussion for another time, so please feel free to shut me down if you think. Commissioner, when we had Dr. Hine in last week to talk about the jobs outlook, he gave us some pretty bleak numbers on what the workforce is going to look like over the next 20, 30 years. And so it doesn't sound like this analysis you did really geared towards how we attract, you know, the right kind of employees here to Minnesota. But is that something that DEED is working on now, the kinds of programs that might attract young families, keep the 55 and older crowd here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Obermueller, yes. We work closely with, for example, the Minnesota Department of Education, the Office of Higher Education, the 16 Workforce Investment Boards, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, the Private College Council, and others. I would bring to your attention a website that we work on collaboratively with all of those partners and others, and it's called the Internet System for Education, Employment, and Knowledge, or iseek.org. And it is good in its current form. You will see in about 60 days an updated form in which we ask the question, what occupations do we expect to have positions at good incomes in the future, and what educational opportunities are available to access those. And then that information helps a wide variety of decision makers, whether it's Minsky College presidents or school board leaders or workforce investment board leaders, make decisions about the industry clusters where we expect there to be jobs. And the bubble chart that you were acquainted with by Mr. Isaacson is part of that information, but there's also a great deal of local information available to answer the question, where are we likely to have jobs? And some of it we use the thinking that you may be familiar with Dr. Jim Collins' book, From Good to Great, and people developing their personal plan that brings together what do I love to do, what am I good at, and what am I likely to be able to make a living at. And that's what we see as the key, and I think it's a big part of that.
Mr. Chair, just one more follow-up, if you don't mind. It seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me we're talking about looking at it kind of from the backside, that where will we have the jobs in the future? What is going to happen to us in the future? And that's an important thing to look at, no doubt. Is there a plan at DEED now for kind of taking the bull by the horns and directing us in the way we want to go to make sure that we've got the kinds of jobs that are going to pay the good salaries to good workers in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, great question. The question you're asking is, are we both trying to communicate so that there are people for the existing jobs, but can we do anticipate jobs that aren't here yet to fill job descriptions that may not exist yet, to solve problems we may not yet know are problems? If you've seen the web presentation Shift Happens that's made its way, it comments that some fairly large percentage of the careers we're educating young people for don't exist today. We are working with a lot of partners to try to do that. It isn't easy. But, for example, the Green Job Task Force and the Green and Clean Technology discussion has led us to a National Department of Labor grant called WIRED, Workforce Investment for Regional Economic Development. That is around principally clean technology or energy, bioenergy and biomaterials areas. We're heavily involved with the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota trying to anticipate in the six bio sectors where there's likely to be employment. We work heavily in the wind energy business to anticipate that. We've identified and worked closely with the Humphrey Center at the University of Minnesota and with a program from Harvard called Microeconomics of Competitiveness. And Representative Poppe mentioned the work being done in southern Minnesota by the RUFRI group, which is the Rural Policy Research Institute from University of Missouri, and an economist named Mark Gravenstein.
And it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to sit in an office in St. Paul and say, what do we think might happen in 2020? We need to get out and talk to a lot of people, and we've been in the process of doing that. It has been most active, very honestly, in southern, southwest, west central Minnesota, and to some extent northeastern Minnesota because of the minerals and mining cluster. There's been less of it done in the metropolitan area. The metropolitan area is somewhat diverse in its organization. There are five workforce investment boards that work together under a metro workforce investment board, but they're also busy in their own right. We don't have a regional economic development entity in the metro area that we do in way we do in greater Minnesota. We also have a larger and more dynamic economy. So we do spend a fair amount of time trying to work with groups to anticipate what will the jobs needs be in 2020 or 2030. It is an inexact science. We're certainly open to suggestions as to how we might be able to do it better.
Take the prerogative of the chair. As you mentioned, the Humphrey Institute, and we were talking about some kind of a overarching plan. This fall, in response to a question about DEED from one of the students who asked if we had a plan, I think your response was that it's too complicated and moving too fast and we don't really have a plan. Can you explain to me how we go to businesses in the state or businesses in the East Coast, West Coast, Sweden, wherever, and say, we don't have a plan, but we'd really like you to come and, you know, create a business in Minnesota. I mean, I don't follow that. I have a plan for every bill that I'm going to introduce. I have a plan for everything I'm going to screw up that my wife will point out to me. You know, he doesn't have a plan? Has it ever had a plan? Does it ever plan to have a plan?
Mr. Chairman, let me. The question was, do we have a single economic development strategy? And my response was, because it is a very diverse state, we believe that it is more effective to have regional strategies. And as you, I believe, met with Bonnie Elsie from our Workforce Development Division, we've identified about 15 industry clusters and sectors that have plans and that we work with closely. And we work with the areas of the state that have received grants under a program called FIRST, Framework for Integrated Regional Strategies, to assist them in developing effective regional strategies, because Minnesota is so different. It's the only state in the nation that is in three major global watersheds. It is the only state in the nation other than Alaska that is in five separate biomes. The economy is dramatically different in southwestern Minnesota than it is in southeastern Minnesota than it is in northeastern Minnesota. The metropolitan area even has multiple economies. So we do have a strategy, which is to assist our regions along the line that economic development has come to Minnesota in three principal ways: through assisting current companies to stay in Minnesota and grow, through attracting companies in key industries from other parts of the nation and the world of late, and in helping entrepreneurs start and grow businesses. The detailed implementation is more regional in nature. Now, we do, as a part of our work, have a unified plan called the Workforce Investment Unified Plan that brings together a great deal of what we do. But it is not the economic strategy that the student asked me about in a class at Humphrey, where, for example, we have a plan that we work with with the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota to outline or to approach the six clusters within BioBusiness, and then we work with our regions on implementing. We have a plan that student asked me, they wanted I do not believe that in a state as diverse as Minnesota, a single economic development strategy is appropriate. We have a cluster of related economic development strategies in a diverse economy, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner McElroy, does that lend itself to the ability for the legislature to not do? I look at our workforce training programs. I look at a variety of our business development programs, and I really get the impression that somebody took a shotgun and sawed it off till we get an even wider shot. And you know, you got about a million different holes in the wall. And I'm just wondering, do any of them work? And how do you keep a handle on 100 or better different programs ranging from training to small business development. I mean, frankly, reading the statutes, some of them are so micro-focused that it would not work anywhere other than a small geographical area of maybe 10 miles by 10 miles. I just, how do you come to us and ask us to give you some overarching authority when it's awfully diverse and not diverse, but it's awfully scattered? That's kind of my problem, because we would like to come up with some kind of a policy that everyone can look at and say, this would probably work.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have a lot of programs that have been developed over a long period of time. Some of them go back to the Wagner-Peiser Act of 1936. They have come to deeds through a variety of areas. We do report to you in an annual report that was just released, and in reports from most of our major programs, like the Dislocated Workers Program reports results on wages and placement at the time that people are in the program and thereafter. Job Skills Partnership reports. Virtually all of our programs report. In a perfect world, would we consolidate some of those? Not very easily, very honestly. Some of them have a variety of federal funding streams. Some of them have resources that come from the Workforce Development Fund, a handful from the General Fund. But you're absolutely right. We have a lot of programs that have been developed over a long period of time. I don't know that that's unusual or unique to our agency. Many other agencies have a large variety of programs. And in many cases, they were designed to meet specific needs. The Urban Initiative Fund, for example, is nearly 20 years old. It began with some federal legislation, but it's to help micro loan programs and early-stage entrepreneurs in low-income areas, principally in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the First Ring suburbs. I wouldn't want to give that up because it's very helpful where it's used, but it is a narrow program. The same thing happens with a handful of our other programs. And we'll do our best, Mr. Chairman, to report results to you. And I get results. I'm very results-oriented in terms of our agency. But it is a big and complex state, so having a lot of programs, we do our best to make them fit the needs where we can. If we started over, we'd have fewer programs. I don't see that we have the opportunity to start over.
I have about a dozen different questions here. But I also have a couple of other members that have requested, indicated they'd like to ask a question. I can come back to a couple of mine. Representative Gutwall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner McElroy, I am very interested in the results piece, and I think it would be good for us to hear that information at some point. What results are we getting for the various programs that we're putting out there in either economic development or workforce development? Specifically around business leads, I know a lot of regional and local economic development initiatives or efforts or organizations rely on leads from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And just some idea along the lines of what you were reporting earlier about how the economy's impacted us. How have we got some metrics around the number of leads we're seeing? Has that dried up? Are we seeing more or less of them? And then it's kind of a follow-up to that, maybe a bit of analysis about how Minnesota's tax and regulatory environment either helps or hinders that.
Well, Mr. Chairman Ripson Gottwell, leads are reciprocal. Some of the projects that our teams work on, both on workforce and economic development, come from local Chamber of Commerce Grow Minnesota calls or local economic development calls, and then some Grow Minnesota calls or local economic development calls. And then some we bring to them if they came in from national location consultants or from trade shows we attend or from the MinPro website. If you haven't looked at mnpro.com and looked at your own community, you may want to do that. It gets a fairly significant number of hits, and it's a good source of leads for us. The number of domestic leads had been very slow in October and November. The number of leads from international companies, particularly in a variety of manufacturing areas and energy, was pretty good last fall. Then it dried up in October, November. The last two or three weeks, it has rebounded. We've had a couple of announcements. Moventus was announced in October, a Finnish wind turbine company that's building in Faribault. Hydro Controls, a company from Italy that essentially makes hydraulic systems for farm equipment manufacturers. that is building in Red Wing. Just announced and very exciting an expansion in Benson, Minnesota by Case New Holland. They've chosen Benson out of about 20 U.S. locations to add capacity, and they've taken over the former Red Ball manufacturing facility in Benson. That's very good news. We have an announcement I am anticipating that I can't jump the gun on because the European company will announce it, I hope, next week for another European manufacturer. We did announce a Portuguese partnership called Horizon Wind Energy in October. Right now, we're seeing more leads from European companies and to some extent from Asian companies because of the availability of capital. But we're starting to see some things move a little bit. The governor has been concerned about our tax issue. While we have a great many corporate headquarters, we have had difficulty attracting some of our largest companies to expand manufacturing in Minnesota. But they had some progress. Graham has had three expansions in recent years here. Cargill, on the other hand, unfortunately, has elected to expand in Blair, Nebraska and in Iowa. We'd like them to manufacture more here. The business climate is not a single issue. Taxes are important. Workers' compensation costs are important. Unemployment insurance costs are important. Health care costs are important. But the quality of an educated workforce is important. The number of professional services that are available, the robustness of industry sectors and clusters is important. The reason we've had these successes with Europeans to some extent is our proximity to their customers. John Deere has indicated that they want all of their vendors to be within 200 miles of Waterloo, Iowa. Well, a lot of that area is in Minnesota, and we've used our technical college system as an advantage. We've used our proximity to an international airport as an advantage. JobZ has helped us with Moventus and Hydro Controls and some others. We fight for every job. We don't lose them all, but we lose some. We lost a very large General Electric expansion to Aberdeen, South Dakota, and they told us it was about taxes principally. We lost two of the big turbine assemblers to Iowa. Taxes was one component, wasn't the only one. The fact that Iowa was more central between the wind markets of North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and those of Kansas and Oklahoma had a role in it. We certainly know that taxes are an issue. They aren't the only issue.
Members, we will be hearing tomorrow about goals and results from DEE, hopefully. So just so you know, we'll have a bit more to say on that tomorrow. Representative Winkler, you had a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the question first would be, what are, we have 10 minutes left. You had a dozen questions. I probably have twice that many. we're going to hear more on this goals and results piece, but what types of questions would you like us to focus on, if any?
There's a variety of areas you could go on. My questions that I have, I will get answered, and I will share with the committee. So, other than goals and results, I certainly have concerns about a plan, an overarching plan, and how they intend to implement it. But okay. Feel free to pick from your 24.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it was last week we had Steve Hine come in, Commissioner McElroy, and talk about the labor market. And while we talked a lot about cyclical change that we're going through right now, we also had a brief discussion about structural change that's going on in employment in Minnesota. And you don't have the benefit of the slide in front of you, but I'm sure you're well aware of the fact, which is that starting in around 2006, employment in Minnesota has fallen below the national standard considerably and has remained below the national standard. And equally, the unemployment rate for the first time is at or above the national average. And again, Mr. Hine talked about 2006 being kind of the watershed year. I guess the question I have, starting from that, is do you have an explanation or... and he didn't. I mean, these are not necessarily things that you can explain easily. But the question is, do you have an explanation? Is there a way for us to get an explanation or an understanding as to why that structural change might have occurred at that time? Because that, to me, is far, far more concerning than cyclical changes, which we really can't control in Minnesota.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and Bob Isaacson is here, and Steve works, Dr. Hine works for him, and he can help me if I get too far afield. currently, our unemployment rate is slightly below the national average, and our job growth is a hair better. But for the first time since World War II, at least, since we've had good numbers, our unemployment rate was above the national average in several months this year. And it's the statewide seasonally adjusted number that we use, and certainly concerned about that. A state economy is a collection of the industries and the employers within the state. And as I indicated, the best answer we have is that we had a number of industries that underperformed the national economy. The largest of those are housing-related. Building materials manufacturing, for example. We have 7 plywood-oriented strandboard manufacturing companies in Minnesota, some of them very large employers. The 3 Ainsworth plants are closed completely. The Weyerhaeuser Trustville plant in Deerwood is closed. The plants at Norbord and Louisiana Pacific and International Buildrite are operating but below their normal levels. Companies like Anderson Window and Valspar Paint and Marvin Windows are operating below their normal levels. Building materials distributors are very slow. We've lost significant jobs, as the chairman knows, in a variety of construction trades. At first, it was principally for single family, but that has spread to commercial, industrial, virtually every segment of the construction business. We've also lost about 5,000 jobs in mortgage finance and origination, trust and closing services, jobs related to the single family issue. At the same time, we've gone through a restructuring of the airline business that has resulted in the loss since 2006 of about 7,500 jobs in Minnesota. In past recessions, we have seen medical devices and other high-tech industries rapidly add employment. We went through, all the medical devices are doing well. You may recall a series of recalls and hiccups in that business. Ford Motor Company has reduced employment fairly dramatically. The economies are complicated, but we have had at a time when we have had cyclical downturns, we've also had these more structural issues. Now, there are a couple of segments in the industry of our economy that are doing fairly well. Financial services outside the mortgage business, for example, shows some growth, and it's growing faster than the national average. Healthcare and education have been doing well. Our health insurers, for example, are doing well. But we are very concerned about, and to the best of our knowledge, the sectors of the economy that have underperformed the national number are disproportionately represented in Minnesota. Let me just look at Bob and see. All right, he's nodding his head that I spoke correctly.
Representative, I want to clarify, Mike. Commissioner McElroy, I understand that you have a wealth of numbers and statistics. I don't really necessarily need to have every statistic spoken to in the committee. I think we all knew the strand board problems and some of the other things, and you know, we don't have a whole lot of time. So if you could keep your answers a bit shorter. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I guess the question I have stems from the I think you said best of our knowledge, and maybe Mr. Isaacson or Dr. Isaacson, I don't know if that's correct, you know, could assist in the answer. But I'm wondering, where do we get the information? How do we know? I mean, that's a fine hypothesis. It seems reasonable and common sense that it's just unfortunate that starting in 2006, Minnesota happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time,
yeah.
And that's never happened since the World War II era. That could be the case, but it seems to me it's a very important question, and I'm wondering what the quality or source of research is that would support that hypothesis or not.
Let me ask Bob to come down. But Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, the short answer is most of the numbers come from sources like the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the U.S. Census. And they are done to national standards, and Bob can explain exactly how we come to those conclusions. I've been asking the same questions. You know, why is unemployment high? It has to do with industry sectors. Mr. Isaacson and I are Mr.'s. Dr. Hine is a PhD. I try to give him his title. He isn't real fussy about it, but Mr. Isaacson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The job numbers themselves are all generated in a cooperative agreement with the federal government through the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Department of Labor. Those numbers, when they're released, we try to as a department and within our Labor Market Information Office, try to do some comparative analysis looking at how we're doing in individual industry sectors relative to other states, and try to look at macroeconomic and at some point microeconomic trends to try to better understand what's happening. For example, airline industry is a wonderful example in particular. As Commissioner McElroy mentioned, we've lost 7,500 jobs in the last several years. We can look at our performance has been much worse than other states. And then you start to look at other reasons why this might have happened. You start to see, well, at 9/11, Northwest Airlines merger with Delta, all of that contributed to a significant restructuring in the airline industry.
Well, the bankruptcy of Champion Airlines, the decline of Sun Country, the sale of Masaba to Northwest and then Delta, the airline industry has been greatly impacted. But it was an industry that our competitors didn't have, but that it's experienced a great downturn in the last 2 years.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Quickly, you've got about 60 seconds before the end of the committee, so go take one more shot, sir. Because I didn't get an answer to your question either, so.
Labor numbers, I can understand where you get that from and you compare to other states, but I guess the question that has to be asked is, has something structurally changed in Minnesota's economy starting in 2006 or not? And when Dr. Hine was here, his testimony was, that's a great question, and we don't have an answer. And I guess I'd like to know the level of confidence that you place in the labor statistic and how well that's backed up by economic models for the state.
And that's not actually, I don't think you're going to get the answer here because I'm going to end the committee. Hopefully you can get an answer to them. I will tell you, my question is, what did we start doing in 2006 that we hadn't been doing for the previous 50 years? Because that is very frustrating. You indicated that we were a slight difference in unemployment numbers. We have led the nation in having better numbers.
Yes.
We have led the nation in having high-paid jobs. I think that is one of the questions that Representative Winkler was trying to get at. And, you know, I know you used to be a politician. You're now a regulator. You did a pretty good answer to that one. I didn't get an answer. I'm going to ask this question, and I'm going to end the committee, and you can pass it along to us. The governor's putting a lot of faith in green jobs. I don't have a definition of a green job. I would be interested if you have one and if you would share that with the committee. I appreciate you coming. There's more questions to this, and hopefully we'll be able to get some answers and have another time with you. I'm sure you'll make yourself available.
Mr. Chairman, I will. Mr. Isaacson can make a definition of green jobs. We've been working on that with the Green Jobs Task Force, and we'll provide that. We'll look forward to further discussions with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner and Mr. Hines, or Isaacson. With that, the committee is adjourned.